Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is John Kreicher, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Wheaton College, Norton, Massachusetts, where for 48 years he taught ecology, ornithology, and vertebrate evolution. And we're continuing our conversation about his new book. It's really good. The Peterson Reference Guide to Bird Behavior. John, welcome back to the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, although we have a tendency, as two of us are very interested in bird behavior, we sort of go off the rails.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be back on the show, and you're absolutely right about that.
This book, the more I read it and reread it, the more I want to emphasize for the public, this is a book for the general public. And the thing about birds, we've said this before, and I'll say it again, you really have a decent chance of seeing interesting bird behavior no matter where you are. You can be downtown. You can be in your backyard at their feeders. You could be at a beach. Birds are doing stuff. And unlike mammals, unlike reptiles and amphibians, and I have a real soft spot in my heart for reptiles, you can really watch bird behavior. So this book really brings you into that world to get you to understand what you're seeing.
Yes, I agree with you, Mark. That's one of the reasons that motivated me to focus on bird behavior in writing a book about birds. There's heavens knows how many identification guides
out there.
And every one of them is fine. And a lot of those ID guides have aspects of behavior in them. Even if you go back to Roger Torrey Peterson's field guide to the birds, he talked about how you can see certain behaviors in birds that are key to their identity, like tail flicking and that sort of stuff. But I think that the general birder may have a bit of an underappreciation for the diversity and nuance and remarkable nature of bird behavior, and that was what was motivating me to do the book.
I think it's a great book for that reason, because it lets you enter the world of the bird. And let's talk, we're going to talk about molting.
Okay.
Birds covered by feathers, feathers age and abrade. So what is a molt?
Okay. To begin with, what you said is one of the most remarkable characteristics of birds is that they're covered with feathers. And I ask your listeners to imagine themselves having several thousand large objects made of keratin piercing their skins all over their bodies, which nonetheless feel comfortable and which you can move with little muscles connected with nerves so that you can flush, fluff them out or smooth them down or raise your crest or spread your wings. So feathers are remarkable. And they're very strong structures. They are made of keratin. The feathers are dead, technically, when they're in their fully mature state. And so when the bird loses a feather, it's not much different than hair dropping off. But feathers are far fewer than hairs on a mammal. And so and they do require intense maintenance, because a bird flies through the air, and the air is abrasive. It's got particles in it. Birds then move through difficult environments like forests, grasslands. They come up against all sorts of obstacles that also affect their feathers. And when you look at a good picture of a bird that you may have taken with your point and shoot or whatever, you'll see the edges of the feathers are frayed. They age. And in fact, aging is built into it. When snow bunnies acquire their breeding plumage, it's really from abrasion of feathers. When starlings lose the spots that they have in the winter, it's from abrasion of feathers. So it's an absolute must that birds go to the equivalent of the Bird L.L. Bean store and change their wardrobe on an annual basis. And then it gets complicated, and that's what we call molt. It happens.
In each species, there's a different molt cycle. There's a system to describe these molts, the Humphrey Park system. But birds have different molt strategies. And if people have ever been to the beach and seen a big group of gulls, a lot of times they'll be the typical looking gulls with the gray and the white, but then you'll see the ones that are brown or different streaked and stuff like that. These are because they have different kinds of, they molt into different plumages as they age.
That's true. And the molt of gulls is one of the real complex challenges for birders to try and enjoy, because it's truly not easy to compartmentalize it. In fact, the term cycle has been brought in, as you know, that there's a first cycle herring gull, which translates roughly to that bird was an egg a few months ago, and now it's in its first plumage, which is quite different from what it'll eventually attain in about 4 years as an adult, and this will be gradually shifted from what it looks like now to what it will look like in 4 years. And part of that will be based on the nutrition the bird has, the health of it. But molt is fundamentally part of the annual cycle of birds, like nesting. And just as nesting is a highly diverse thing, I mean, you can characterize it as, birds lay eggs, they put them in nests, but then the diversity of places where they lay those eggs and how they build those nests is really quite remarkable, and that's sort of what molt is too. Even within a species, as you can have a species of bird that has different so-called migratory strategies. You look at a thing like a towhee, for instance, and some of them are migratory. Some populations are fully migratory. Some are seem to be only partially migratory, and some are not migratory at all. That's how molt works. I think it's, I know it is, chipping sparrows in the east, they generally molt after they breed, and then they migrate. But chipping sparrows in the West don't. They go to a different area to molt, and that's because it's more food-rich. Molting is very energy expensive, and so these so-called molting strategies are built in to local and regional populations by the fact that they work. Birds that do them are the ones that are most successful and thus come back and nest. So it gets complicated in a hurry, but the thing that every birder obviously should know is that birds have to change their feathers on average once a year, and the way that that's done is variable depending on what the bird species is, and some species, such as the larger ones, don't have to really change all their feathers every year. Sometimes, particularly the wing feathers, it takes longer than a year for that to happen.
Now, waterfowl, and let's talk about mallards. There are times when they're molting when they're essentially flightless.
Yes.
And what I've noticed here is there are a number of ponds where they seem to congregate to molt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ponds where they're safe. There's a lot of emergent vegetation. They're not going to get hassled. But for that time period that they're flightless, they often group together.
They do. The males particularly do that. Females do too. For the males, of course, it's what birders like to refer to as the eclipse plumage, because they don't appear to look like what they ought to look like. and so they're eclipsing.
Female type plumage.
Yep, they've gone behind the moon, and they slowly grow out their flight feathers, that's not entirely unique to gulls, not entirely unique to waterfowl, but it is one of the most characteristic aspects of their molt cycle.
Now, birds have what are called ectoparasites: mites, lice, ticks, fleas, including the ticks that carry Lyme. But one of the weirdest ones, and I got a chance to see this, and I just have to bring this up because this freaked me out when I first saw it, louse flies. Louse flies are freaky when you look at them.
They're not the size of Cocker Spaniels. These things are so totally scary. I had a mot-mot, which is, as you know, a tropical bird, in my hand as I was banding it in Belize years ago. And I looked on the neck of this bird, and there was the most ugly insect I'd ever seen glaring at me. And it was one of those louse flies, and then it just disappeared right into the plumage.
It's always eerie when they do that. It's like a bittern in reeds. They just sort of duck in there.
Yep.
And it's
so you, You can see birds scratching themselves all the time.
Yeah.
Some birds will scratch over the wing, some under the wing. You know, I even talk about that in the book. But that's what they're scratching for, is they itch. There are things there. A lot of the feather mites, I don't know whether the birds feel them or not. They're so tiny. But certainly things like louse flies, which feed on blood, could make them want to scratch.
We're going to skip around a lot because there's so much. I want to mention, people, every one of the topics we're talking about, there's a lot more information in the book. I want to talk about birds bathing, because that, mm-hmm. for beginner or expert, it's always entertaining watching birds bathe. It's always group, especially if there's a group bathing experience, like starlings in a puddle on a road. It is hilarious to watch.
Well, there's something interesting about birds that people can relate to very easily. If you go into a room full of people and there's somebody who starts to yawn repeatedly, pretty soon you'll see other people yawning. And that seems to be what happens in a number of ways with birds. You just mentioned one of them, bathing. They'll land, one or two of them will go into a puddle. I've watched snow bunnings do this repeatedly, yep. And then it's a group endeavor. I have a photograph in my book of bush tits.
Excellent photograph.
Yeah, they just spontaneously came down to this little puddle. They were all bush tits, of course, are highly social. And they all landed down by the edge of this puddle. And one by one, they went in and started bathing. And I have a picture of an adult male boat-tailed grackle just, you know, looking like a whirlwind bathing. And that was just part of a group of them. They do that spontaneously. And there's a number of other things they do spontaneously, too, like... you mentioned molt before. Preening is something a bird has to do daily.
That's right.
And you'll see groups. I study snow bunnings, so I've seen a lot of this with them. But they'll be all feeding. They'll be in an old line feeding, and then a couple of them will stop and start to preen, and a couple of more will start to preen. And pretty soon, the majority of them, if there's 20 of them, 16 or 17 will be there preening. They do this in groups, and you kind of get the sense that they stimulate each other to these kinds of behaviors, which are really essential behaviors.
Now, there are preen glands. Talk about those.
The preening glands are found at the base of the back of the bird. It's called the uropygial gland, technical name that all ornithology students learn. And it's a kind of oily substance which the bird can put on its beak. And it's something I remind my readers of, is that birds have extraordinary necks. Their necks enable their head to turn almost completely around, and the neck's long and flexible. And so the birds have no difficulty really reaching back to the base of their tail and stimulating the uropygial gland to exude the oil. The oil is then... on the beak of the bird, and it proceeds to rub the oil through the feathers. And I think ornithologists are still wondering exactly what the total utility of that oil is. It seems clear that it is feather maintenance, but there's still questions being raised about what the oil is and how it conditions the feathers, whether it retards the wear and tear or whether it eliminates things or reduces things like feather mites.
There's also dust bathing, and you most commonly see it in house sparrows. But turkeys dust bathe too. And when turkeys have taken off in population and show up in people's backyards and then start to dust bathe, they literally create a rut in the backyard.
Here at near where I live, I show folks these little craters of dust which the house sparrows create, and we also see it with turkeys, gallinaceous birds. Anybody who has chickens knows they do this, but a lot of birds will do it. I watched a brown thrasher at dust bathing a number of years ago down in Georgia, and it was just along this the edge of the road. The road was very, very dry and dusty, and this bird just went to town, and there's plenty of water around, so it did the dust bathing by choice. It didn't need to do it as an alternative to aquatic bathing.
So what is it accomplishing, though?
Hal, that's a great question, and I don't really know. Again, it must be, I'm not sure any ornithologist has really conclusively shown what advantages dust bathing confer to birds, but there have to be some advantages to them. And again, the thing that you always come up with as a potential answer is you're dealing with an animal in nature that has a very valuable anatomical component, its feathers, that is that are subject to parasitic infection and bacterial effects on feathers. And so there may be something in the dust that retards that. And the bird typically, after it dust bathes, you've probably seen this, it fluffs its feathers many times and then will start usually to preen.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight. It's always great to talk to him. John Kreicher, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Wheaton College, Norton, Massachusetts, where for 48 years he taught ecology, ornithology, and vertebrate evolution. And we're continuing our conversation about his new book. It should, if you have any interest in the natural world, this is one of those things that should be on your shelf. The Peterson Reference Guide to Bird Behavior. Now, John, something that I've seen only a few times, and it's weirded me out every time I've seen it, anting.
Yeah.
Anting is fascinating. I saw it first, I think it was, I was birding in Britain, and green woodpeckers were diving into these specific kinds of ant nests, which would give out this formic acid thing. It smelled like pickles. And they would sort of dust bathe in it. But here, I've actually seen scarlet tanagers pick up individual ants and rub them through their feathers.
Yeah, and blue jays will do that, too. I've seen blue jays anting and very few other species. It seems like my anting list is low. Number of encounters with blue jays doing it. Flickers also. You mentioned green woodpeckers, and they like flickers, feed on ants as food. And so they encounter them all the time, and it would be logical to think that if anting has an advantage, it would be some of these ground woodpeckers that would have figured it out first. But blue jays certainly know about it. And I guess what, to answer your question, the hypothesis that's always offered up is that ants, many of them are pretty dense with formic acid, which is a pretty caustic compound.
Oh, yeah.
And rubbing that through their feathers, kind of like rubbing chili peppers, and that may really do in some of the parasites that they have, or make it, or at least reduce them. I don't think there's anything that makes the bird feel good about putting the formic acid on the feathers, because the feathers don't have any particular feeling of their own. The birds feel their feathers through the base of their feathers and through the unique feathers called phyloplumes that are mixed in among the feathers that detect, you know, the orientation of the feather. But I think it probably reduces the parasitic infections that they get, but I don't know how they figured it out.
Now, there's some cool
stuff. To get back to that, there must be a direct cue between the anting and the satisfaction level of the bird with doing it, or they wouldn't do it.
I know. I watched this. It was on a dirt road. I watched this scarlet tanager one by one catch the ants and then literally run it like over the down the feather. So it was
which feather? Wing feathers?
It was wing feathers.
Yeah, wing feathers are vulnerable, and wing feathers, from bird banding, we learned a long time ago, you can hold the feathers up to the light and get a general sense of the density of wing mites in them, feather mites.
And that brings up the next thing I want to talk about, sunning. I've seen occasionally in my backyard at feeders, all of a sudden I'll look out and there'll be a grackle or a jay doing the weirdest thing. The wing will be stretched out completely. The primaries and secondaries spread, and it's at a weird angle in the sun. And it looks like it's hypnotized.
Yeah, it looks like it's really in a zone.
Yeah.
And I watched a male robin do that. And as you know, that it is the males that tend to raise the kids after they fledge until the kids are independent. And this juvenile robin, still with a speckled breast but fully worthy of flight, had its feathers, came up and looked at Dad and immediately adopted the same posture.
Oh, wow.
And just flattened itself and spread its wings and spread its tail. And again, you've raised a number of questions which really get at the very essence of how complex bird behavior is, because
right.
it's just very vexing for humans to try and figure out what the function of these behaviors happens to be. Is it possible that just makes the bird feel good? One of the things I sometimes throw out to my students is, do you think birds are capable of being happy? Do birds have enough of an intellect to feel happy about something or content? Certainly they feel pain. There's no question about that. But how do they express pleasure? And is sunning some form of pleasurable behavior? I'm not saying it isn't functional in the sense of adding to their survivorship, but they may just like it.
Well, you have a photograph of a great blue sunning in the book that I've actually seen them do it. The wings seem to droop and then scoop out. So they're like holding one of those sun things that people hold on their face. And what they really seem to be doing is warming up.
That's true. I think there's another thing that they do, though, with that same posture. When I was in South Africa a couple of years ago, there was a gray heron that had exactly that posture, and it was at Kruger National Park on one of the hottest days I think I've ever experienced birding, and it had its wings wide open, and it had its mouth open, and I think it was trying to lose heat.
That's fascinating.
So I think they can use the posture both ways. They can use it to gain heat, and they can use it to lose heat.
Let's talk about roosting. Here in the winter in New England, you can see some spectacular roosting behavior if you just look up.
Yep.
Crows, magnificent group roosts in the wintertime.
Indeed. I've been to the Lawrence Crow.
Oh, you have? Okay.
That Craig Gibson and Dana Duxbury and Bob Fox monitor so well. And it is quite an ornithological adventure to watch that kind of thing. I mean, there are so many questions about it. And I've seen a number of areas where crows have gathered before they've gone off to roost as well.
That's right. Yeah, they sort of those are sort of somewhat on the periphery of the roost itself. And there's a lot of there's a lot of vocalizations while they're in that area. Then they go to roost and they're quiet.
Yeah, they're having a lot of chit chat among them. Then you see this with robins as well.
People think that robins move south in the winter. There's always some robins in Massachusetts, and sometimes huge numbers of them. There have been roosts in Whately along the Connecticut River Valley. There have been thousands big in these arborvitaes.
That's right. There's a robin roost relatively near where I live because I see groups of robins flying by late in the afternoon, all heading in the same direction.
It's amazing. And these.
I think the group roosting is phenomenally interesting because why do they have to all bunch together? Is their risk of predation that high? Certainly that's not true of crows. Crows could roost individually or in small groups, but they, for a reason that is clearly a choice, they roost in very large groups, large assemblages. And, one idea for that is that since food is not exactly overly abundant in the middle of winter, winter at least, they use the roost as a somewhat information source and follow the healthiest, best-looking crows out in the morning to see where they're going to feed. And, you know, you could argue that for robins as well because they feed so heavily on fruit, which is a bunched-up, clustered resource in the winter that roosting behavior may be, again, an information center for the birds. But still, that explanation leaves a lot to be desired.
We just have
we
just have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about this means that birds sleep. But as you point out in your book, their sleep is not like mammalian sleep at all.
Certainly not for some of them. It's not. I don't know with a bird like a house sparrow, if it sleeps with both sides of its brain asleep at the same time. But it seems clear that a lot of the birds, such as shorebirds and migratory birds, can sleep with one hemisphere of the brain sleeping and the other hemisphere fundamentally, at least partially, awake.
I've seen that in scop flocks where you see one eye is sort of open and the other eye is closed.
If the right eye is open, the left side of the brain is asleep, awake, and just the eye, because
they're crossed
the
over.
Cross. Yeah. So if the right eye's awake, it's the left side of the brain that's awake.
And I love you for doing this. Birds don't tuck their heads under the wings.
No, they don't.
Thank you so much for putting that in print.
They tuck it in the scapular feathers and the back feathers. In the case of some of the herons, I've got a picture of a black-crowned night heron. They simply fluff out their breast feathers and take the beak and face and put it down and fluff over the breast feathers. And they can be quite comfortable for the night.
And shorebirds, especially long-legged ones, are often sleeping on one leg.
Yeah. How many of us have been asked by people who know we're birders how these birds, you know, lose their legs? Because I saw three of them together, and they only had one leg. They were hopping along the beach. Yeah, well.
We're completely.
I was watching this. I've got this wonderful picture I took last week of a sharp-shinned hawk, immature, sitting in. I was eyeball to eyeball with it because I photographed it out a sixth-floor window of my apartment, and there it is with its foot on the branch, one foot on the branch, and in what looks like where the navel would be for a human, there's this cluster of yellow, which is the other leg. The foot was tucked in the branches, but it just protruded a little bit. A few of the toes were showing.
Well, and, you know, people got to realize most bird feet are bare. Therefore, they are very susceptible in wintertime to frostbite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what did in that great black hawk that showed
up
in Maine.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We're completely out of time, and we've just been talking about one chapter. That's why this book is so good. This book has got that kind of information in it. My returning guest tonight is John Kreischer, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Wheaton College, Norton, Massachusetts, where for 48 years he's taught classes on ecology, ornithology, and vertebrate evolution. And we've been continuing our conversation about a book you could talk for years about, The Peterson Reference Guide to Bird Behavior. Again, if you're at all interested in the natural world, this is one of those basic great guides that you can get and read, and it'll tell you what you're looking at. John, thank you so much for your time.
It's always a pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.